Imagine you have a die in your hand. You roll the die. It's one of six possible outcomes here, each equally likely. It's relatively straightforward. If you were navigating uncertainty, as the consultants like to say, then you can do scenario planning. You can come up with a scenario for what to do if it's a one or a two or a three or a four or a five or a six. Now, if we were to complicate things a little bit and add an additional die and add the two dice together to create the sum of the two, then if you do this enough times and roll enough dice, you'll start to realize that there's a pattern to be discerned. The number seven is the most likely result you'll see. And this means then, from a strategic perspective, you can start to factor in probability. You can take a Bayesian approach. You can say, okay, well, here we are with the business, or here we are with the organization. This is the most likely, the most probable outcome here. But let's also consider a few edge cases, just in case things don't turn out exactly as we had planned. And so then we do the scenario planning for the edge cases. What happens if we get a 2? What happens if we get a 12? Very unlikely. But maybe we'll get a 6 or an 8 or a 5 or a 9. So what do we do if that happens? And so folks will spend their time doing the scenario planning. And this leads to a wondrous illusion of certainty and control and clarity as a people, you know, we've put in the work, we've been very thorough, we've mapped out the scenario. From a Parkinson's law perspective, where work expands to fill the time allocated, consulting firms can invest a lot of time to come up with various scenarios and present them in beautiful PowerPoint slides and PDF decks with the stock photography of if this and that and so on. And yeah, everyone feels good because we've put a lot of work into this. I think you can sense where I'm going here. Navigating uncertainty is a blinkered approach. It's good, it's needed, but it's very limited. It's not the pathway to strategic differentiation. And it can delude us into feeling as though we're prepared, which then perhaps leads us to be less effective when the context changes. And if there's one thing I'm certain about at the moment is that we are entering a period of volatility within the world, geopolitically, within business, artificial intelligence, exponential disruption, ecological devastation, metacrisis, etc. We are in immense volatility. And so therefore, I'm incredibly dubious about scenario planning alone. It's an important thing, but it's not the only thing. With scenario planning and approaching the concept of navigating uncertainty, it's like we're proceeding through a fog and, you know, there are multiple pathways within the fog. We can't see the pathways yet, but once the fog clears or once we navigate it, the path will reveal itself. And that's fine, assuming that there are already paths there and assuming that people have already gone ahead and mapped the path for you. The term navigating, I'm also not so sure of. I'm okay with it if we are navigating via poetic sensibilities, via mythical sensibilities, where we're consulting the stars, the gods, our intuition. But if we're kind of thinking about it in terms of a map, then that presumes that someone's already gone forward into the future and mapped the territory so that we can follow this map and or navigate at least by, you know, maybe we take an orienteering approach. You know, we can at least have some mimetic kind of symbols if this happens or if that emerges, that then we get some reference points. That's fine, I guess. But the point here is that uncertainty is not enough. We can't just navigate uncertainty. Ambiguity is where I'd like to take this conversation. See, uncertainty is known unknowns within a closed system. So it presumes that you know the system, you know everything. And this appeals to the engineer, the programmer, the coder, the masculine urge to dominate and to map and to kind of to know the things. But it doesn't deal with the unknown unknowns. And some of you might be thinking, well, what can we do? We don't know the unknowns. We might as well work with what we got. And yes, that's true. My suggestion here is that alongside complementing the navigating uncertainty and all your scenario planning and all your default strength, weakness, opportunities, threats kind of default strategy stuff, is that you will also cultivate the sensibilities and the capabilities to navigate ambiguity. And even navigate, to sense make, to flourish, to thrive amidst ambiguity and the unknown, the unknown unknowns. And this is a very different skill set. And even skill set is not quite the right word. It's a very different set of sensibilities. Sensibilities, a skill is great, but knowing when to use the skill and when not to use the skill, and when the skill itself may be limited, this is the domain of sensibilities. I'm taking a bit of a meta-rational lens to this. It's not merely enough to simply optimize within the existing system, but one must consider systems beyond the system. And in fact, one must consider paradigms as well. So, ambiguity. Now, sometimes I'm asked, where does strategy come from? Actually, I'm not asked. I wish people asked me that more. But you know, let me just point out, the default when it comes to strategy development for most organizations seems to be everyone's really busy all the time. They're overworked. People start to pay attention to some emerging trends. It starts to feel a bit overwhelming. Have you heard about this thing called artificial intelligence? We should probably do something about that. And so we'll get an external consulting firm in to come and talk to us about AI and maybe contribute to our next offsite. And maybe we partner with them. And because of Parkinson's law and scenario planning, we can start to map out all of these edge case scenarios and present, you know, big PowerPoint presentations with lots of details and lots of graphs and come up with big presentation decks and PDFs. And so when it looks like a lot of work is done, Parkinson's law is where work expands to fill the time allocated. And so a lot of expense and we feel like we've know everything and therefore we can start to map out our strategy. It's not like that at all. Strategy emerges from relationality. Strategy is a living conversation. It's the situational, dispositional acuity that allows for us to orientate towards relevant realization. If you are seeking strategy, what you effectively are seeking to do is to make sure that your business model makes sense with the emerging future. Of course, the future is not uncertain, it is ambiguous. There are unknown unknowns at play. And so therefore, we might map out some scenarios, but our orientation is to pay attention, to make sense of the complexity of the unfurling emergence. This means that we have an acuity for weak signals. This means, and I'm referencing Dave Snowden's Kinephon model here, but it means that we not only pay attention to what is emerging, we also develop the relationality, the seniors, the collective genius, the mutual enthusiasm, the encouragement, the support with our colleagues. And we create space for ambiguity, for the exploration of the unknown unknowns. And in my book, How to Lead a Quest, and the Quest Augmented Strategy Model sees the cultivation of a quiver of options, which are domains that are actively monitored and considered. And should the right conditions manifest, then we can start to experiment with them. And so I've been working with some organizations since 2016 that had already been mapping artificial intelligence, smart contracts with blockchain, many other things. And they are well prepared and have been doing very well based upon the conditions that have manifested, not because they have been planning out specific scenarios, but because they've been paying attention and adopting a disposition that cultivates in-house intelligence and sees the folks as learners that are actively learning, participating and sharing with appropriate epistemological humility and intellectual honesty. And through that and the collegiality and rapport, developing a confidence to discern weak signals, and when the multiple weak signals coalesce, to know, I think now's the time for us to start experimenting with this. This leads to strategic differentiation, strategic advantage, and whole new revenue streams and new value and ongoing and enduring relevance. So I won't go too much into the specifics of the Quest Augmented Strategy Model because I didn't actually intend this to sound like a pitch. What I more want to do is posit the notion that there are many related terms when it comes to ambiguity, uncertainty, the unknown, mystery, and so on. And I think it's useful for us to disambiguate them a little bit, or at least to approach it as we would whiskey tasting notes, or, you know, as I often like to do. So, you know, when we sample uncertainty, for example, it's got a rather mechanical thing, it works with closed systems and so on. Ambiguity being much more living systems, unknown unknowns, open systems, and we're sensing into it. I want to point out just a couple of other things related. Vagueness. A lot of people conflate ambiguity with vagueness. Now, vagueness is useful if you have good collegiality and rapport, if you have the conditions for seniors, mutual encouragement and so on, then vagueness is quite permissible. It's okay to be grasping at something. Sometimes concepts themselves haven't quite taken shape yet. And so the words that we use to describe them seem vague. You know, we talk about vibe. We talk about, vibe is great. Vibe is a beautiful word that articulates complex, nonlinear, emergent dynamics that are, you know, if you were to put your finger on anything specific, it seems too weak or too imprecise or kind of misses the point. You know, I can walk into a room and the vibe is off. And, you know, if I was to articulate what's going on here, it's partly because of the artificial lighting. It's partly because of the geometric uniform arrangement of the chairs. It's partly because the whiteboard is not geometrically aligned appropriately. It's partly because the, the drinks fridge there has a big Coca-Cola sign on it and it's humming. It's partly because the pathway in which people will walk in there doesn't really allow for serendipitous encounters. It's very individual. There's a whole bunch of things that collectively aggregate into this vague and nebulous notion of vibe. And nebulosity is something I really love as a related word. Ambiguity, uncertainty, vagueness, nebulosity. Nebulosity is where you can see the shape of something, but it can't be grasped, like a cloud is nebulous. David Chapman of metarationality.org talks about nebulosity. It's a point at which a lot of STEM researchers get to with all of the theorems of engineering, of physics, of mathematics, of biology. Eventually, when you go deep enough, you start to realize that all of those constructs kind of, they serve a purpose, but the foundations that we thought they were built on aren't really there. And there's an inherent nebulosity. This doesn't mean it's nihilism, that nothing is meaningful, although that's a trap that many people fall into. It just means that there's an inherent meaningness to them. More on that, you can check out metarationality.com. But there's also a couple of other things. I want to get a little bit wizardry with you. I find myself fascinated by the occult these days, in the sense that some knowledge is intentionally gatekept. It relates a little bit to mystery, and this term mystery is something that modernity cannot tolerate, is mystery, the unknown. We want to colonize things. We want to map things. We want to make the unknown known. We want to explain things. But in the process of explaining things, we rob phenomena of much of their magic. The explanation is not quite the same as a poetic relational disposition. And there's this beautiful essay by Martin Shaw, the mythologist, Dr. Martin Shaw, on navigating the mysteries. And here the concept of navigation is much more poetic. It's worth reading. But the ultimate thing I want to get to here, and this is me because I work across many different groups and different organizations and contexts, there's a frustration in that many people fixate upon the shining obvious thing, the thing that everyone's talking about. In this instance, it's artificial intelligence. And when you fixate upon something that's shining bright, it means that it's harder to see what exists in the penumbra. Your eyes need to take more time to adjust to what is emerging elsewhere. And often the big shining thing means that we are blinded to, or at least miss, some of the adjacent opportunities. We see this at the moment with Donald Trump and his antics. There's a lot of theater involved with this, but I'm also quite convinced, and my friend Merlin Bowler also pointed this out, is that we can't just pay attention to the central figure that's creating the distraction. And the wise and savvy amongst us have their acuity cast wide. We're paying attention to what is emerging. By paying attention or giving attention, it's curiosity, it's empathy, it's attunement to weak signals, it's active sense-making, it's comparing notes, it's epistemological humility, it's learning. And through that, we find a way. But there's this thing of mystery. Sometimes, I guess my point is, allow more room for mystery in your life. It can only do good for you. But the main crux of where I want to go to in this little piece is this notion of voids and anti-memes. So when you are a wizard who spends much of their time in the noosphere, the sphere of human knowledge and thought, maybe more than human as well, I don't know, you start to get a sense for, and you may get this too if you're also terminally online, you start to get a sense for where the conversation, like what is where mind share goes. But then also you start to notice voids, you start to notice gaps, or a mysterious lack of conversation, a mysterious lack of publication or sharing around particular concepts. And a great example of this is when Greta Thunberg started to connect climate change to capitalism and colonialism. And suddenly she became, she was the darling of much of mainstream media. And now she's portrayed as the villain, if she's mentioned at all. And when you start to discern what within our memetic landscape is salient, as in which is noticeable and discernible, and what is, and where the voids are, where the conversation quietens, or we just do not see the things, this becomes very interesting. You won't see any mainstream media talking about, constructive criticisms towards capitalism, which is the prevailing paradigm that we're in, because perverse incentives are at play. There's a really important video when it comes to artificial intelligence and the superorganism, in which Daniel Schmachtenberger has a conversation with Nate Hagans. It's a 3-hour conversation, but I consider it to be essential viewing or listening for anyone that is considering the second, third, and nth order effects of artificial intelligence. I've shared this video with many friends and colleagues, and very, very few, I'd say perhaps, out of the 20 that I've shared it with, specifically as a one-on-one recommendation, only two have actually watched it. And this is where I sometimes feel that there are anti-memetics at play. This is a term that came to me from a book by Quantum, read quite a while ago, There Is No Anti-Memetics Division, which talks to the notion of ideas that are actively cloaked, that kind of resist perception, as in things that you won't even remember having seen or learnt or recognised. And again, if we get a little bit wizardry here, or at least a little bit attuned to magics, I find there's this interesting thing that happens. If you're reading a book or an article, say, and you find yourself... you find your attention wanes and you just can't seem to hold the concept. One potential explanation for this is there could be anti-memetics at play. I'm getting like intentionally a bit mythopoetic and supernatural here, like for utility purposes. I don't know if I actually believe this, but there are concepts so foundational, so pervasive that they become invisible. There are systems that we swim in or paradigms that we're in that we can't even see. There are hyper objects like climate change that are too vast to actually point at or grasp to. They're inherently nebulous and we might talk to parts of it, but we can never really grasp it or it never really stays with us. And there are things that are silenced not just by censorship, but... there's this combination of insidious elements of disinterest, distraction, and one might consider also, if we were to reference Bill Plotkin and other adult developmentalists, arrested development. We have a situation at the moment where we don't have the conditions that allow for cognitive complexity and warm sense-making to flourish. Part of the conditions, and David Graeber has pointed out this, is because capitalism sees us working so much and fixated upon boosting productivity, we end up with this Jevons paradox in which as we get more productive at doing things, as the efficiency increases, the demand for that increases too. We're going to see the same thing with artificial intelligence. We might think that it will liberate us, but the chances are we're going to see a backfire effect in which the demands of our attention and our time only increase. Now, this is not certain, And this is part of the ambiguity of it all, but it does require that we keep our wits about us and remain paying attention. And one of the things I'm commonly saying when it comes to artificial intelligence is you have to keep your wits about you. One, because the tool itself is so incredibly effective. I use it. I love it. I don't like how much I love using artificial intelligence. As you know, I'll link again to the article I shared a while back on a bunch of must reads for those that are considering artificial intelligence, in which I linked to Josh Schrey's wonderful podcast on the Notion. So you want to be a sorcerer in the age of artificial intelligence. We are working with powers here that are exponentially greater than we've ever had before. And the fan of possible outcomes, it's always infinite, but the fan of possibilities, if we were to plan for scenarios of what might emerge in the future, that fan has never been greater. And so there is so much for us to factor in here. And part of wit, having wit, means you have associative knowledge. If you're quick-witted, if you're sharp-witted, and so on, all that essentially means is that you can pull disparate ideas together in a synthesized way that is relevant, timely, and apt. And my hope is that folks within organizations are cultivating in-house intelligence. And by that, you're actually cultivating genius. And by that, I'm talking about collective genius, mutual encouragement, the conditions that allow for flourishing and the development of each other as adolescents into adults. I'm not even sure if I'm an adult yet. I feel like we have much maturing to do. I feel like intelligence has vastly outpaced wisdom. And I feel like wisdom itself is an existential threat to most business models. And so the perverse incentives keep us from having the conversations at depth about this. And yet, that is where we need to go. So this has been a bit of a romp. My main point here is there's so much more than simply uncertainty when it comes to our unfurling future. And if you want to do strategy well, yes, plan to navigate uncertainty, do your scenario plannings and so forth. But alongside that, you might want to consider also cultivating the sensibilities, the capabilities, the savvy to flourish amidst ambiguity and the unknown. This will have you orientating towards relevance realization. It will have you cultivating a quiver of options, which allows you the optionality to be able to respond to emergent phenomena with a kind of grace that may outpace your competitors, if you believe in such a thing. And ultimately, it's the most enlivening thing we can do is to have curiosity, empathy, acuity for what is emerging and to orientate our actions so that we're moving towards real value, not just merely additional profits or incremental gains on existing systems, but actually what does value really mean? How might we contribute to the generation of that? I hope this has been a useful provocation for you. It was meant to be a 9-minute musing, but here we are. Enjoy your ambiguities, your nebulosities, your vagueness, your mysteries, all of the things, and I'll see you next time.